Okay, welcome. My name is Mario Rodriguez, and I'm here to talk to you about the lessons that my team, Team Foundation Server, actually learned through dog fooding, and we'll get a little bit more into that later. Before we actually start the talk, let me get a hands up for the people who actually know what Team Foundation Server is. Okay, so the majority of you guys, so the people that do not know what TFS is, really quick. One, two, three, four. Okay, so I'll describe it very simply for you guys. It's an application lifecycle management server, and it allows people to actually collaborate while building a product. So the services we introduce is version control, work item tracking, reporting, build, and things like that. So if you could compare it with Rational or with something, Perfor, for example, does something similar to, and Jira and Atlassian are what you consider competitors of Team Foundation Server. Later on, if you guys want to talk more to me about it, then in the Ask the Expert section, I'll be there after the talk. Okay? So the second thing is I have a lot of content, and this kind of talk is best when it's interactive, meaning I really want you guys to ask me questions. You could ask me through the talk. Just raise your hand, and I'll call on you. And feel free to ask anything you want. And the second thing is I have some content at the end, meaning that we might not get to it unless I actually make a priority on it. It's really not about dog fooding. It's about our experiences in taking TFS into the cloud, and more specifically, taking it into Windows Azure. So do you guys think you want to see that content or no? For the people that want to see something about TFS on Azure, just raise your hand, and then that will allow me to make a priority for that. So not a lot of people, so I would not make a priority for it. If you guys want to get more information, then see me after. And if we actually get to it, then we can. Okay. All right, so today, I really wanted to actually label the talk this, how not to screw up like we did. They didn't let me do that, of course, and I would have been more explicit on the screw up. But that's really what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about the mistakes that we actually made and how maybe you can learn from them. So I call this thing like opening the kimono. You know, like that I'm going to be very open. You ask me any question you want. I promise to actually answer with all truth. Or never lie. I'll tell you that much. So anything you want to ask, product related, not personal, then that's okay. Okay? So. Okay, so a little bit about me. I joined Microsoft in 2002. I actually work in the Xbox group. I started working in the racing division of Xbox. I did games like Project Gotham Racing, and then I also did the AI in Forza Motorsport. I did the design, the tuning within the game of that. Then I actually moved to Team Foundation Server, and I worked in version control for around 3 years. I was the program manager responsible for branch visualization, and we have a couple of patents on that feature. And now, right now, I'm responsible for the underlying platform to take TFS into the cloud or into Azure, and looking at what that means and what can we do with that. So that's me. So our possible agenda, and I think I already covered what I wanted to on that, but we're going to be talking about how is it that we actually use Team Foundation Server to build Team Foundation Server, and then the lessons that we learned along the way, how did it taste, and what have we learned. So dog food. Dog food is a term, I don't know if you guys know what it is, but we're really not eating dog food every day. What we really mean by dog food is the following is, by Wikipedia, is when a company uses the product that it makes as part of the everyday life cycle. So in this case, what we're really saying is when we build Team Foundation Server, we're actually using Team Foundation Server. And not only that, we are actually using the version that we're building. So prior to you guys getting it, we already are testing with it probably for months in advance. And currently, we already have deployed the first build of the next version, and that's what we're currently using for every day So that's what we mean by dog fooding. It's really using our own product every day for the development of the product. So TFS and Microsoft, before I talk, let me give you an idea of how many TFS instances there are there and what is the scale of what we're talking about here. So throughout Team Foundation Server, we have 42 instances, around 20,000 unique users. This stat is a little bit outdated, probably by 4 months or so. A lot of team projects, thousands of them, 7.9 million work items, and 95% of the data we actually store today in TFS is all version control data. So as you can see over here, this visualization of what that looks like. And it gets a little bit more technical if anyone wants to really, since this is a 200 level, but a table version and the local version rows are really the majority of the content that we store in Team Foundation Server. So how big is big? So throughout all of this, we have around 1 billion files. It's how many files Team Foundation Server stores today within Microsoft. We have done around 2 billion check-ins, meaning our developers are very happy checking in. And we have around 1 million work items and around 17.3 terabytes of data. And one of our servers is actually around 4 terabytes. And if you ever try to actually recover a server in SQL of 4 terabytes, you will see how long it takes. So we do a lot of nifty things to be able to actually have a very good backup and recovery story within Microsoft. So it could take 3 weeks to recover if you don't do it right. So we also use it for our project management solution. So we actually go and say, hey, we're going to divide what we're going to be doing in scenarios. Then after scenarios, we actually go and do experiences. And then we divide those into user stories. So it's kind of agile in that way. We have our own terminology for it. But from a scale perspective, at least within our division, we have 116 scenarios, around 1,600 experiences, and 7,900 user stories. So this is what we work with on every day. Probably not even close to the scale that you guys have. So a lot of the things that hit us are scale, and some of them are actually not as well. So just to recap that, we have around 8,000 user stories within a release, 12,000 errors and iterations, or 11,000, but very close to the 12,000, 2 million check-ins within a product cycle, and 1 billion files. So that's the magnitude of our use of Team Foundation Server. Any questions on that? Okay. So, and if you want to understand a little bit how we deploy it, we separate our analysis services from our warehouse. We have an application tier that there's actually load balance. And then we use EMC Symmetrix for our SAN. And you can see the other stuff. We have a lot of proxies because our team is dispersed throughout. I actually live in North Carolina, not in Seattle or in Redmond. So I work out of that proxy. And we also have a build lab with hundreds of machines that execute our builds daily. So that's what it looks like from our deployment perspective. Okay, so now we're going to actually get into the lessons we learned. The first one is we started too aggressive. Okay, so you could see that dunk is not going to go anywhere. We did the same thing. We actually went, and this is back in 2005, we were developing the server, we were dogfooding the server, and the dogfood at that moment was our team. Our team started rather small. When I joined the office, it was around, I think, 40 people. Now we're upwards of that. But our team was very small. Everything was doing great. Now all of a sudden, we said, you know what, we're going to open it up to the division. And the division is around 2,000 developers, more or less. And when you open it up to 2,000 developers, all of them checking in very constantly, our server fell on the floor immediately. Immediately. I mean, it probably didn't take more than 10 days. So we say, that did not work. So we're going to start a rollout. And we started with probably, a little bit more than our team. And let's not do the version control. Let's start with work item tracking. And let's put the process people that create the process, let's see if they could use it. That also didn't work very well because we didn't envision all of the scenarios that a big product management team like Microsoft was actually going to want out of the system. So we started the rollout again. And it probably took us around 6 months to a year before we could actually get something out there that the division can use. And then after that, we really learned about other things that would make it better. And then all the way up to 2 years, then pretty much everyone is using it and kind of happy with the product at that end. But one of the big things that we actually learn out of this is with anything that you do, you have to really understand what are the scenarios out of what you're building, what is the personas, what are the consumers really after, and then test at some limits and do a rollout that it's kind of, think about every 3 months or kind of in a timeline is what I would say. You see this a lot with services nowadays. You get the service out there first, you start learning through it in beta mode, and then you start rolling it out and you start expanding it. So the same thing applied. Now, back in 2005, we did not have that expertise, and then we kind of fell on that. But main thing, again, is phase your rollouts. Even if you're deploying TFS within your company, try to actually do Uptpilot first. Then after that, go and actually do a rollout of a team. Learn a little bit, and then you could go and actually tackle, if you have an organization like, you know, 100,000 consumers, tackle that. Now we could scale very, very, very large. But back in 2005, we were not able to. When facing your rollout and understanding your architecture is critical for those type of things. So that's one of the first things that we actually learn. The second thing is that we buy more than we can chew. What does that really mean? It means that whenever we envision what we're going to build, we're very, very optimistic, incredibly optimistic, if you ask our developers. Because we always want to do so much, and especially before when it was a box, but whenever you have to have a box product that cannot be very easily updated, then you have to get it right at the first time. Your customers will not forgive you if you ship something that is completely crap, right? So you have to get it, you have to test it, you have to validate it, you have to get it right when it's a box product at the beginning. People do not forgive you. And our beta periods are kind of small, and our customers do not move as fast. The majority of the people that do our betas are people that are either on the leading edge with a product or are MVPs and things like that. The majority of our customers probably don't deploy our product 1 to 2 years after we release. So because of that, it puts a lot of pressure on us to deliver the right features into the marketplace. Due to that, we usually go and expand our scope too much. And what we find out is, look, the majority of the time when you actually do that, we kind of buy more than you can chew, you're not going to be successful. So what can we do to make it better? What can we do to actually deliver very high quality to our customers while at the same time keep up with the demand of the marketplace? And what the demand of the marketplace means is the features that need to be delivered for our customers to be successful. So I remember, how many of you know who Brian Harry is? You guys don't know him. Okay, so he's a technical fellow at Microsoft, and he's the head of Team Foundation Server. And when I say technical fellow, there's only like, huh? My boss's boss's boss, yes. So kind of thing, yeah. Great guy, though. He's the one who actually did SourceSafe, and then he sold it to Microsoft and things like that. But and when I say technical fellow, I just wanted to understand, there's like less than 20 people of this in Microsoft, and we're like 100,000 employees. So a very, very bright guy. But I remember being with him in a car ride back from Redmond to the airport. We were going back to Raleigh, actually, and we were trying to discuss, okay, what is it that we can do? We know that we could ship things out of band, and we have these things that are not by we, I meant the Microsoft community and the Microsoft company. We have this thing called Power Toys out there. Usually the SQL has one. I think Windows had one at that moment as well. But people in the enterprise seem to be laughing at them. I actually went to a customer, and I told them about some of our Power Toys, and they were like, toys for real? I'm like, we're not going to install that ever. I'm like, okay, so they're not really toys. I mean, we spend a lot of time making these things and making sure they're very, very good. So what we decided to do was, okay, look, let's go and actually educate the community in what, and we renamed it from Power Toys to Power Tools, and what really the effort that goes into these things. And let's leverage these Power Tools to actually be the thing that we utilize past the shipping cycle to deliver very high quality features to our customers. And that's how kind of like the Power Tools, we had like 10 names that we discussed, but all of them sucked. I guess Power Tools was the one that won. But so Power Tools is really what we use to actually deliver out of band and take care of this. We buy more than we can chew. Now we could actually go and say, look, if this feature does not make it in the release of the product every 2.5 years or 3 years, we could now ship it as a Power Tool and be able to deliver the functionality to our customers as well. So that's how that started. You could download them today from the Visual Studio Code Gallery the release by us. Usually we updating every 4 months. That's the cadence that we try to keep. And there's a lot of good functionality in there. They're very high quality features. And if you have any problems ever, you could utilize the forums or there's help in other places as well. But that's one of the key things that we use to actually deliver very high quality functionality to our customers after we release. So if you have a product yourself, I invite you to actually be creative and think, unless you have a service. In a service, it's a lot easier because you control everything end to end. But if you do not have a service, then I kind of invite you to actually think of creative ways that you could deliver functionality to our customers outside of the release cycles. So you could actually keep on track with demand and keep on track with what the marketplace is doing. So that's our second lesson learned. So it's impossible to ship everything in the box. And we have found that out time and time and time again. No matter what we do, we usually go and say we're going to do this many things, and at the end we could only get half of that done or more. I'm being a little bit pessimistic on that, but nowadays we do a lot better. So the next one. For the longest time, we did not practice Agile. Actually, we were probably beyond waterfall. If waterfall is something, that's probably very good for what we were doing at the beginning. And you could see some of it later in some graphs that I have. But at the beginning, we were like, okay, we're going to go and code for n amount of time. We're going to stabilize. We're going to have a beta 1. We're going to code again. We're going to stabilize. We're going to have a beta 2. We're going to code again. Not really. We should actually be stabilizing all that time, but there may be some DCRs based on customer feedback. And after that, then we go and ship. So everything was like that. You do these 10-page specs. You kind of define everything end-to-end at the beginning. And that's how we actually did project management back in the early 2000s. So, but what happens with that is that you miss a lot of things. And not only that, we were not really then dogfooding the Agile part of Team Foundation Server. And you could probably have seen that through what, if you utilized at the beginning, the CMMI or the Agile templates, they were not as good as the other ones were in the market. Even the 2010 release, after that, we came up with a power tool that was actually a Scrum template. Because by the time we released in 2010, the market had already moved from Agile, and the majority of the people were doing Scrum or Kanban, essentially. And we did not have anything on that because our development was back in 2008, 2009, and those things were, the market hadn't decided yet who were the winners on Agile. So, and then we came up with the power tool. But so things like that, if you don't utilize Agile, we were not dogfooding. We missed some of the things our customers really wanted. So after 2010, we made it a priority to actually go and utilize Agile. So how did we go and do project management then back in the early 2000s? We had a lot of graphs. That was our life. Well, not mine. There were other people doing that. But all I had to update a lot of these things. Was very, very annoying. But we had a lot of graphs. We had graphs on what we were doing and the progress we were making. That's the one at the top right-hand corner. We had graphs about the product bugs that we were incurring, about the quality gates, and pretty much everything was through a graph, a lot of qualitative analysis on that. And then we go and make decisions on that data. So if you want to get more context on it. So in TFS 2008, what you will call a sprint now in Agile, back then we would call it a feature crew, was essentially 10 to 12 weeks. So our development time frame for a feature was around 10 to 12 weeks, which is a very, very, very long time that you're spending on one feature. Then from once we created TFS 2010, that actually went back to 6 weeks because we were saying, you know, in 12 weeks, we cannot actually get the necessary visibility into what we're building and be able to iterate on it. You know, whenever you build something, the same thing, you're never going to get it right the first time. You have to iterate through it. So to give us that time frame, we cut it back to 6 weeks. We did a little bit better way of planning, and then we iterated on that. At the end, we probably proved out to be a 12-week cycle as well for a feature. But now in, let's go forward and back. Now in what we call Dev 11, our sprints, and now we fully adopt a Scrum, our sprints are 3 weeks. Some people like 4 weeks. Some people like 2 weeks. 2 weeks for us, since we're big, is practically impossible. You kind of wake up every day and you're like, hey, there's a new sprint. But so 3 weeks is a little bit better. And even on 3 weeks, what that really means, if you want to understand it, is 10 days of pure development. The way I think about it is the first 2 days of a sprint, you're trying to really figure, at least the developer is trying to really figure out what is happening with the feature. Then there's 10 days that they have of actually development, and they have 3 days to actually stabilize and shut down and polish whatever they're building. So 3 weeks, 15 days of calendar time, that would actually, not calendar time, but of actually work time, that would actually give you 10 days of development, which is not much, a lot, but allows us to be a lot more agile. We finish something in 3 weeks, we could take a look at it, we could see the quality of it, and then we could react on it on the dime. So that's our evolution, and we really like in our sprint model right now. It allows us to be a lot more flexible. Allows us also to see how can we load balance, why teams are not going to make certain features, and make decisions essentially a lot earlier in the product cycle. So the way it is done from an execution perspective, we plan these 3 week sprints, then we pick a point where we want to stabilize that work. And right now it's between 4 and 5. So every 4 and 5 weeks, we actually go back and see, okay, what have we built? How can we make it even better? And then we call that, and then we start sprinting again. And we call every time we stop, we call that a milestone. So that's how we are actually structured today. Any questions on this? On how we actually do our development on that end? Nothing? You guys don't have any questions. And you guys know a lot of things then. Again, don't be shy. Just ask me anything you want. Okay, we got one taker. How big are your teams? That's a good question. Okay, so we actually, so everything on this, the entire dev division is around 3,000 people, right? And then what you do is you start breaking those down into what business units, and then from that into the actual products and things like that. So let's say TFS. In TFS, each what we call feature team is probably 10 to 15 people max. So in your stand-up, you're going to have something between 10 to 15 people. And the majority of the teams actually do the stand-up standing up, meaning we have a projector, a computer, and we're building something that allows you to do agile in this way very, very nicely. So you just plug in your computer, your projector, and then everybody comes into the computer and says, okay, this is what I'm doing. Imagine a virtual task board. And just drags and drops what they're doing, and that's how we get data on what the team is doing and the team communicates. So it's around 10 to 15 people. We do not have a scrum of scrum, which is something that we're trying. Meaning, these 10 to 15 people, there's not one person that later goes into another scrum and says, okay, this is what my team is doing. And there's not another person that goes into another scrum and says, hey, this is what these 700 people are doing or 300 people are doing. So we do not have that. We keep every kind of feature team in an autonomous way, and we'll get into more of that a little bit later. And we leave, there's a person that is called the release manager. That's a position within Microsoft, and their job is to actually make sure that you release on time and with quality and kind of executes a lot of things on that end. That person then communicates with other people, but not in a scrum or scrum fashion, just informally through a meeting that they have weekly. So that's how we do that. So the main thing is we do not have a scrum of scrum, and our teams are 10 to 15. Anything else on what we do from an agile perspective? Nothing else? Okay. So then the other stuff that we actually do as well is we have sprint done lists. We also have milestone done lists, and we also have a user story done list. To be able to actually make sure that we are done, or whatever the term is in the agile world. So what we do is we have a video every time we actually finish a feature. We go and do a retrospective on it. We triage all of our bugs and understand the debt that we have, and that's pretty much it. And then we do that at every end of the sprint, and you're free to RI, or meaning integrate or merge into the main line. So that's how we do that. Very, very, as you can see on this, it's very low overhead. And that's mainly because of another one of our learnings. So in our experience, agile development leads to better decision making. We have been able to make a ton of decisions very, very early in the product cycle, which we wouldn't have been possible before. Because before you wait 12 to 16 weeks to actually make a decision. And that's just too much. At that moment, you cannot make the best decisions. So we encourage a lot of our customers to actually utilize Agile because of that. And hopefully the majority of you guys are doing that today. So, and then in my opinion, it doesn't lead only to better decisions, it leads to better everything in your product cycle. You know, the communication between the team is a lot better, and the development and the morale and everything is significantly higher. So, the next one. So back in 2005 and even in 2008, one of the reasons that we did not use Agile is because we had way too much process. And kind of that process and the people developing that process in Agile, you know, it took time for those two things to actually gel. We had a lot of process, and to a very easy way of understanding if you have a lot of process is just take a look at your work item tracking form. And that means when you're opening a defect or an issue or anything like that, just take a look at that form that you fill out. You'll understand just by that how much process you have. For example, in ours, it was like this. This is a screenshot, by the way. This is not me making it up. This is me taking a screenshot. Let's see what this is. This is a bug. It's the 372,000 bug that we have in this server. And project admins are a member of Contributes group after PCW. PCW is the project creation wizard. So just look at how much status stuff we have. Essentially it's like a 767 cockpit, in my opinion. You know, it's like incredibly, there's a lot of process. You know why we have so many fields? Because we have a lot of process. That's really why. But that's not everything. If you actually went and expanded everything, and that's 56 if you actually want to count them. If you went and expanded this to be all of the tabs that we had, we had over 96 visible fields in our work item tracking form. 96 fields that a person can fill out with some type of information. So that pretty much was an eye-awakening moment of, okay, division. We just cannot move one step without filling out a field, essentially. So every time you had to do something, there was a work item tracking field you had to fulfill. So what that really meant also was that there was not a lot of autonomy to teams. And if you ever never seen the or never read the book Drive by Daniel Pink, it's a very, very good book in my opinion. So and he talks about autonomy, mastery, and purpose. You know, autonomy is the urge to direct our own lives. Then mastery is the desire to get better at that. And then the purpose is actually doing something that we do in the service of something larger. So think about the Wikipedia editors and things like that. Those are people that want to have a purpose in that. So what that really meant, those 96 fields, is that a lot of our teams did not have the autonomy necessary to execute. So we went back and I wouldn't say we negotiated, but we went back and sat back with our PPO team, or the people that actually are in charge of doing all the project management for the division, and worked a lot with them in trying to figure out, okay, how is it that we can make this so we have full autonomy back in the feature teams, especially when we're everywhere throughout the globe. We have some offices of course, in the United States, North Carolina, and Redmond, but we also have in Europe, we also have in India, we have some offices in Australia as well that develop something for, not necessarily Team Foundation Server, but through the division. So when you have these teams all, and these are product development teams, not sales teams, not marketing or anything like that, these are people actually developing code for the product. When you have this distributed environment, how can we make it so that everyone has the autonomy and the purpose and the mastery necessary while at the same time being able to give visibility and clarity to you guys? And we went and developed this system where we have independent teams right now. All of them are doing their own. Usually it's an Agile. The only team I think right now not doing Scrum is the VS Pro team, but they're moving to Agile as well. It's just the transition time was a little bit tricky for them. But we have independent teams. They all define their own processes. We have one main cadence. That's the thing that the division actually sets, meaning, okay, milestone X finishes here, milestone Y finishes here. And we have one way of actually reporting throughout all of that to be able to give everyone the visibility, and then one leadership team that makes all of the decisions, and that leadership team, it's very clear who are the decision makers are and how to actually go and talk to them and allow them to make those decisions. So we went from having 56, 96 fields to something considerably smaller, and not only that, each team actually controls its own destiny when it comes to the process and what they have to fill in and how they want to do bugs and how they want to actually do tasks and things like that. So that's another thing that we learned. So One key thing of that is make sure that you're always taking a look at your process. Simplify it as much as possible. That's what we found out. That will give you a lot of velocity. And not only that, provide full autonomy to your teams. We think it's incredibly valuable. Even though, like, if you think about it, there's 2,000 developers, let's say, right? A very, very, very good developer would only break a build probably one time in a year. So if you actually do that, that means if you divide, your build is broken every day, essentially, okay? If you do the math on that, even though your build is broken every day, we still tell our division, hey, allow us to be autonomous. We'll find ways to actually make the process so we do not break the build every day. We have things like get a check-in and things like that. But provide us the autonomy, even though that you require things to be shipping at a very high quality. High visibility in order to make the decisions. So autonomy is one of the best things that you could actually give a team. Okay, the next one. We tried to do everything in Visual Studio. And what that meant is that, okay, look, we are Visual Studio team. Well, of course, we love what we do. So it's kind of like a hammer and a nail. Let's use Visual Studio for everything. And we used it for project management as well. And what we found out is that project managers and Visual Studio, you get into a broken relationship. Your heart will be suffering continuously. And I mean that. At least my heart suffers continuously if I have to use it for project management. So in that kind of, you saw that a little bit in our product. Meaning in 2005, our Excel integration was very, very thin. It was still good. I mean, I loved it, but it was very, very thin. That was because our product, even through dogfooding, all we used was Visual Studio. So, of course, we did not realize that our Excel integration was thin or that we needed to put more in there. Well, after that, and before all you could do was put your work items in it and things like that. This is more 2010 now, I think. But after that, we realized, you know what? Project managers don't like being in Visual Studio. First, Visual Studio takes 300 megabytes or 200 megabytes, and sometimes the project managers don't have machines that can actually handle all of the CPU and memory that Visual Studio needs at times. Second is they think it's an alien software. They know other things. They do not know VS, right? So from that end, whenever they open it, even if it is only the Team Explorer, meaning you don't have all of the other IDE capabilities, that was still the Visual Studio shell. So they were still going, kind of thing. So I remember joining and going like that. Why am I using this thing for this? So what we did is, look, project management is done. Some people like using project, and that's perfectly right. We'll give them the integration for that. But Excel is very, very powerful for project managers. Not only that, also web UI that is very centric, and by that I mean very focused on the activities that you do, is also extremely, extremely valuable for project managers. So what you're seeing and what you'll see in the future from the Team Foundation Server team is a movement from Visual Studio as a center of everything to be more like, you know, there are other clients that become part of the center of TFS. Visual Studio is great for developers and testers that code mainly. And that'll be the best tool that we'll have for them. But for project managers, Excel and a web-centric UI are probably the best tools for them as well. So in 2010, we introduced the ability to do more of the refactoring of your project backlog into Excel. We also introduced an agile workbook at that moment. We also had an ability to take a query from Visual Studio and export it to Excel with a bunch of reports. So you're starting to see the migration then from a Visual Studio-centric project management into more clients that fulfill the necessary roles. So that was one thing that we learned. So again, if you're doing your project management today in Visual Studio, please stop that and use something else. Even if it's working right, I want you guys to start moving away from that end. So. Next one. We made some bad calls on reporting. What do I mean by that? So we did a lot of reporting, but just for this, how many of you guys know what RDL is? RDL. Ooh. More than these statistically, only 5% of people know that. So maybe it will come. How many of you guys actually can write an RDL report? You see? Not even me. I mean, actually, I could write one, but very simple. After that, then you could take my hand away. So our technology to writing reports at the beginning was, hey, you write RDL reports. We ship some in the box, go read that code, and write other ones. That didn't, unless you actually are in IT infrastructure, that is very, and you have your job was to do that, no one else can actually do one. It's incredibly complicated. And we fought, you know, I fought Microsoft for that. We should have another technology that is a little bit easier. And Power Pivot, how many of you guys know what Power Pivot is? A couple of you guys. Okay. And there's now Excel technology that allows you to do reports very effectively. So we made some very bad calls on two fronts. One of them was that we required people to get visibility into the project to actually write RDL reports. And you could do other things too, but the majority of the power was in that RDL infrastructure. And two of them, we rely on the warehouse and the analysis servers way too much. So all you could get in reality is statistical data, not real-time data. And we suffer through a scenario on that. So if you update a work item, now you have to actually wait until it makes it into a warehouse, which is another database, and then makes it into the analysis services queue. And then you could actually go and get the visibility on it. Well, if I updated something I want, it might not be until 24 hours until that cube updated. So we were always constantly cursing that because we didn't have the ability to make real-time decisions or real-time reporting on it. And there was a lot of reasons for it. There were, you know, technical reasons that existed and it still exists today. That we needed to fix to enable real-time. All data feeds is what we're really moving to at the end, if you guys want to understand where we're going in the future. But all data will be the technology we will be utilizing. But so those bad calls on reporting actually meant a lot of other things. It meant that, one, our project management team could not get all the data necessary at the right times. It also meant that we didn't have the reports we needed to actually be able to have the team understand how we were doing, and things like that. So in 2010, we moved from having all of that to only creating RDL reports to having a little bit more deeper integration with the office. And now, it's part of the Microsoft Office server team as in SharePoint. But in SharePoint now, you could actually go and have Excel sheets that you could create reports using the Excel functionality and then just the rendering engine and show them in SharePoint. So what we did was integrate with Moz, now I remember. So we integrated with the Moz server and allow people just to actually be able to get the data necessary into Excel, create a simple report through Excel, and just make it available to their team. That deeper integration was extremely good for us, and that's why we did the majority of the life cycle in 2010. We also included a lot more reports out of the box for the people that actually wanted to get that data. In the future, our move is to all data feeds, and ability for you to get all of these feeds and actually do what you want with them, more integration with Excel and Power Pivot, and so like that, anyone can build any report they want out of the data that is stored in TFS. And that's what we're moving towards on it. So if you have a need for reporting, I invite you to actually take a look at all data and see if it meets your needs, if it's something that you guys want to use. So, but one of the main things that we learn through this is that reporting must be easy. If it's not easy, people will not use it. If it's also a lot of latency in it, people will not trust it. So try to move to a way where reporting is very easy. Data visualization, as you guys know, is very popular, it's very demanding. And so the more data you can visualize, the more frameworks you have on that, the better your team is going to be. So another thing that we did wrong was that we went fast, and like really, really fast as that car can go, which is really fast. I'll show you a graph that explains what I mean. So this is 2005 beta 1. Okay, if you actually can even see, and I don't have a pointer, but if you could see this line over here at the top, actually, let me. This is just our trend line on the curve. As you can see, we call this crash landing. Is what we call it at Microsoft. This is a plane that you're just going like this, and usually the product that turns out is not very good unless you do a lot of things right and cut a lot of features and things like that. It's either that or you delay the product launch. It's your two alternatives for that. There's ones that are a little bit steeper, but those are even suicidal missions. So that's one thing that we kind of look at. If you have a trend like that for bucks on a very big team, that's very bad. But if you look at this line on top, that is $30,000. That means by the time that we gave you a product for beta, our testers or our team knew there were 30,000 things that were wrong with it. 30,000. I don't know if you know, that's huge. Like really, really big. So, I mean, 30,000 things that we knew were wrong. Now, just think about, I mean, let's say usually 10% might be duplicates or things like that. Okay, that is 27,000. Cut a couple of things for error here and there that no longer repro. Okay, 25. Still, 25,000 things wrong in the product. That was not a very good beta. Actually, at the end, we ended up delaying, I think, Visual Studio 2005 a couple of months once we understood that. Now, 2008 beta 1, we were around 6,000 on it. That means if you think about 2,000 developers, that's $3 per developer. Now, that's manageable. That's something that we could actually ship, and that's probably something that has very, very high quality. And as you can see, if you look at the trend of how we actually did that, it was something like this instead of a very, very crash landing, essentially what we call it. So you want to understand, and the reason why I'm telling you this is you want to understand depth. And depth is, bugs is part of that, but depth is something that kills you as a team. So something that is more manageable in there. So on managing depth, there's three things that we do now. One of them, we have this concept that you guys might know what this is CBB, and we call it a zero bug bounce. And we introduce the bounce on it because we're realistic. We know that once you hit zero, you never stay at zero. You kind of bounce from that. So it's kind of like a bunny hopping on that end. So we actually set goals and say, okay, we're going to try to hit CBB by this day to really understand what is the velocity of our bug fixing. That's something you want to know. And it's very different per release. You cannot go and say, okay, you know, a developer is going to fix a bug per day or 2 bugs per day or, you know, a quarter of a bug per day. It really depends on what new challenges your development team is tackling in that product cycle. So you want to get a better read about the velocity of your product cycle. So CBB is one of those things. Second thing that we do is we have an exit criteria. And this kind of shows you, it's kind of like a confidence board where you go and say, okay, anything that is green, of course, is doing good. Anything that is yellow, that team is probably having a problem with something. Let's try to help them out. And that means maybe even moving resources to help them out. Anything that is red, we're in trouble. You kind of focus on the reds right away and try to make them yellow as soon as possible. So we have something that allows us to get visibility into how we're doing on that end. And then we also have this concept of bug jail. And what we do in there is we lock the developer in an office, and he cannot get out until he fixes the bugs to get out of that. So it's not like that, but it's very similar. He's not allowed to do fun stuff like new feature development until he fixes all the bugs to get him out of bug jail. And that number depends per team, per product, and things like that. So I cannot give you just like 10 or 15. I think right now it's around, for my team, it is 4 priority 1s, 8 priority 2s, so 12 to 15 bugs per developer until he needs to go and address. Anything that is priority 3 is not counted. He could have as many of those as he wants, more or less. So any questions on this system to be able to manage our depth and understanding it? Okay. So another thing that depth kills. Kind of if you go on that crash lightning, you're pretty much going to die. And your product is going to suffer on it. Next one. We were not very serious about upgrade. So we're dog fooding, but one thing about dog fooding is you want to keep the dog food fresh so it kind of tastes better. If you do not upgrade the dog food, then it's going to taste very bad. You're going to be like, where's the new feature that we actually have? How can I get it? And at the beginning, we're kind of, to tell the truth, we're kind of lazy through it. We're like, okay, we'll update in only 7 months or something like that. And that was not the velocity we needed to be successful. So one of the things that we actually went towards was constant updates. That even means an update to an infrastructure. That means if we have to go and buy new SANs or update our SAN speeds or anything like that, let's try to do that. And this shows you kind of like the velocity that we're having lately. And it's probably now a year late, but you can see, you know, almost every month we're actually doing something in our dog food server. So if you're actually going to dog food, we recommend you that you move to a cadence that is frequent. Clearly, you're not going to do it every night. That'd be insane. Every month, depending on what you're doing, you could either update your software or your hardware. But every month, every 3 months is something that we see that and that we recommend. So this allows us actually to get a lot to get the benefits out to our customers a lot sooner, and meaning the internal people. So you can see over here, this is around the 2008 timeframe. We deployed, let me see if I have, so the blue one is actually the count of merges that we do, because we have so many teams, we're constantly merging code. And the red one was actually how much time a single merge is taking. And as you can see over there, it spikes a lot, and it's taking a long time. And this is because we had a couple of bugs, and also the way that we architected the system, it allowed for this. So around PDC, it was really bad. Our developers, the developers in the division started complaining a lot. We went and did a hot fix to the server. We deployed it, and then at the end, you could see that the execution time is significantly less than our count time, which is where you want to be overall. So before a single merge was taken around, I don't know, it was around 6 minutes or so, even for a one file merge, which is ridiculous. So after the fix, then everything started good, and then customers were a lot happier. So the same thing over here, as you can see, we also track on the Dogfish server what is the availability. We did a fail upgrade that brought us down to zero, so we also make mistakes in upgrading our own server. And we have here what are the things that we're kind of upgrading because. And then after that, everything started good. We averaged more than 3 nines today internally. So we're probably 9.99. I think now we're 99.95. So 3 nines for us, a little bit better than that is what we're doing right now internally. It's still a challenge because you have things going wrong. If you think doing a service is easy, it's really, really hard. You have machines dying every day kind of thing. You have things going on in your infrastructure. There's switches that die. There's sand problems and all those things. So keeping high availability is extremely difficult, even in a company as big as Microsoft and with the resources that we have. So upgrade is what we recommend. Keep that dog food very, very, very fresh. Another one of our learnings is, and I think this one is number two. Another one of our learnings is powerful but simple. And the what in there used to represent what our team thought of it. And it's kind of tricky. I mean, I'm being kind of pessimistic on this end from my perspective, but you could kind of find this in a bunch of places. For example, this is an Office UI. This UI is very powerful. You could do a lot of things over here. You're doing a spell check on it, and you have a misspelled word in here. In this case, it's uncomplicated. So you could ignore all, add it to the dictionary. You could do a lot of things. It's powerful, but it's not very simple. Here's what the Office did to actually go and take a feature from powerful all the way to simple. You know, now I could just right-click on it and say, hey, that's really what I want. I want to fix it from my misspell to uncomplicated. And then I have other things I could do on it. But the action that I want to take, which is really fixing that grammar, that spelling error, is taken immediately. That's what we mean by powerful and simple. And it's really, really, really hard to get and to do from a design perspective. So this UI is powerful. Hell, it's not simple. It's super complicated. And in fact, we hate it ourselves. It's from like 2003, in my opinion. So you could do a lot of things on it, but a lot of people actually do not even understand what they're doing at times. And they cannot actually accomplish what they want, or it doesn't give them the information that they need either at times. So we need to get away from powerful to really having powerful and simplicity. So this UI, and this is from branch visualization and tracking changes, is both powerful and simple. It allows you to understand what your branch structure is. It allows you to understand also how your code is moving through that. So in this case, we tracked a change that most probably was number 88 and how it moved through my branches. So and now I could see that the changes I made in 88 are all in all of those branches, but not in the other ones. Again, powerful and simple. But you shouldn't think only about powerful and simple in design. You really have to go and think about those things when it comes to your process, your workout and form. As you can see, we have 56 fields. Really not simple to use at that moment. Your branch hierarchy, if you have 20,000 branches, you're not going to be successful. Well, you might, but it's probably going to go through a lot of pain. Your security model, how you actually secure your server is important. If it is very complicated, you're going to have a lot of holes on it. Your build lab needs to be as simple as possible as well. Your testing tools. You have to really go from a thing of only power to really go to power and simplicity. And to tell you the proof, you know, one of our main competitors, Apple, does a great job at doing that, right? You can see our Windows Phone right now is really good, in my opinion, on doing that as well. It's very powerful but very simple in the UI. So move to that. Balance power and simplicity as much as possible in every aspect of your application lifecycle management. That's our mantra nowadays. So, and the last one, I give you guys time to actually ask me questions. We set up our cloud server early nowadays. We don't wait until beta timeframes to actually give it to a lot of people. We set up very early in the development lifecycle. And what that really means is that, you know, if we go a little bit later, people are going to be happy. So what it really means, when you do it early, some subset of your customers are going to be really pissed off at you. Really, really upset. They send me mail sometimes trying to kill my mother kind of thing. But it's okay. I understand the frustration and don't take it personally. But what I really want to see in reality is seeing those emails going from that much frustration all the way down to, hey, we could ship this and it's great kind of thing. So things, and by the way, the ADC, what it stands for is activity of daily coding. So what we really track is, okay, the daily coding activities that we do or as we're going through the product lifecycle, how we kind of rate it this way and understand, okay, are we ready to ship or not? And as the number goes down, that means that we are. So one of those things, for example, that our team was really, really on was like sorting on trees. For the longest time, we didn't have that and things like that. So from that, if it tastes like dog food, it probably is not ready to ship, so it's not done. That's what that says over there. So deploy early. That's one of the main things. Take some heat for it, meaning whenever you deploy early, there's going to be people that are going to be really upset at you. Don't take those things personally, and then try to make it better throughout. That's what we found out. If you deploy too late to make people happy, what you'll find out is that you're going to miss a lot of very, very valuable feedback that you could react to. That's the main thing. Sometimes a customer gives me feedback. You know, if it's beta 2 almost a day before I ship, there's almost nothing I could do on it. But if he gives it to me 7 months before, even if he tells me I suck and he wants to punch me, I could do something about it. So in summary, make sure you deploy early. And if it tastes like dog food, like real dog food, most probably it's not done yet. Balance power and simplicity. Upgrade as often as you can. Not too much. Don't go crazy with that either. Debt kills you. Reporting must be easy. Make sure that you actually do that. Because a lot of times reporting is hard for organizations. Visual Studio is not a project management tool. Autonomy is both difficult but necessary. So give autonomy to the teams, or if you're a developer, request it from your superiors. And tell them to send me an email if they don't agree. Agile development leads to better decision making, and it's impossible to ship everything in the box. Make sure you do have things like our power tools so you could deliver things out of band. If you have a service, it's kind of easy for you. And plan your rollout. So thank you very much, and then I'll take any questions you guys have. Anything at all? Nothing? I did an excellent job of that? Okay. Yes. So those, I think, are called feature packs. So what we had is, the way my team thinks about power tools, there should be free to everyone. There are things that make the product better. So we should make it free to anyone that utilizes Team Foundation Server and not charge them. There's a couple of other things that we call feature packs. And those are really like high-end features that we're trying to deliver. And those we try to only make available to people that are in the MSDN community. Now, the ultimate thing, that's probably marketing, and I work in the product team. I don't have visibility into how ultimate or standard or those key decisions get made. But the decision to make it into a feature pack was done by our team, and that's mainly because we want to give you more support. So power tools, you get support outside. You cannot just call customer support and tell them, hey, this power tool is broken. The reason you cannot do that is because in 3 months, we'll probably upgrade it and update the bug that you have. So if you just file it, we'll address it, hopefully. But in feature packs, you could call us and say, hey, this thing is broken, and then we'll have an engineer helping you right away. So that's mainly why. And Project Server, because it is such a high-end feature, we had to make it a feature pack. If not, people will not deploy it because you're going to like the CIO level and things like that. So you have to make it more explicit that there's support and probably months of engineering behind it. So, well, power tools could be a little bit less than that. Anything else? Anything else? Remember, I'm open to making money. I haven't answered anything. So if you came here with one specific question and I haven't covered, ask it now, please. Okay.
You mentioned dog food.
So you're right. So how is it that you will dog food something that you have no need to actually use ever? That's an interesting thing. So, you know, every product I worked on, like in games, I could dog food that very easily. They pay me a lot of money to do just that. But exactly. So when it comes to something like a line of business application that you will never use, how would I do it? So the way that I would think about it would be this way then. I would have, you can dog food it for your normal development, clearly, because it doesn't have to do anything with that. But I would dedicate then times in your development lifecycle where you actually, you're not developing, but you're using the tool. Like, I would separate time to understand, really, and not just live your customers. Like, sometimes, you know, in a line business progression, you could kind of throw it over the wall. So don't do that. Actually, even if, let's say, you either you go through the application yourself, or you then sit down with the people that use it for like a week, and then at that time frame is the way you dog food. So enlist people that want to actually use your app early, even if it's not your team. So enlist people that want to use your app early and have weeks where you go with them on site and actually utilize it and learn from it. So we do that sometimes with things that we ourselves do not necessarily use in everyday development. And we go and what we do is we separate time to go and utilize them with the customer and learn from it. So like that we can understand what are the specific needs of them. But the biggest thing of that is actually recruiting. That's what I find the hardest. Like actually finding someone that wants to go through a product that is not yet done and has time to do that, that's absolutely the hardest thing. Not me taking a week out of my development schedule. So it's hard, but that'll be the only thing that came up to my mind right now. So anything else? Anything about the architecture of TFS? Anything about the Azure? Yeah, so we have unit tests. We also we do a lot of VS tests, essentially. So we have a system where the developer writes a unit test. We also have what we call build verification tests, which are BVTs. Then we have weekly runs and nightly runs. No, I'm sorry, nightly runs, which we call nightly automation runs, and then longer runs. I don't know what we call those FARs, but but we do several amount with the unit tests, we do scale tests, performance tests, any type of test that you could think of, we'll probably do it. So manual testing, persona testing, all of those things. So our ratio allows that for a lot better. We have almost a 1-to-1 ratio from a developer to tester, which some companies cannot afford that, but that's kind of how we do that. And, yes? How many fields? I haven't counted it myself, but I know. So now we also have a new UI that makes it a little bit slicker too, meaning it hides some stuff that we don't want in there. But required fields is only 2 of them. So and then from that, the ones that show at the beginning, I think it's before it used to be like this. Now it's like this. So my guess is cut it by. It's probably 0.25 of what it used to be before. So think about 10 to 20 max. We use it for reporting purposes, but we do not use it for documentation. We use it for visibility and tracking of that. But sometimes we do use it for, like, what is in this build, since that gives us the build integration with workout and tracking. We could go and say, you know what, all of these big bug fixes are in this build. Let's have that build tested now and things like that.
Do you still have some kind of specifications you write?
Yes, we do, but it's not tracking workout and tracking. Only the high-end thing is tracked. But the actual document, the specification, now is very light. We don't have 6 months to write something. It's 3 weeks. So my spec is very, very thin nowadays. And I just learn through it, and I update it as we go. That's the way we do it. So I really like that model. So than the model before, where we had to write a 40-page paper. All right. Anything else? Yes? Is there a way to update the Agile template to a Scrum template? If you ever updated templates, then you know that it's never easy, at least in our product. You have to go through this power tool called the Process Template Editor. And it's not the friendliest tool either. But so, no, it's the answer. I'm not going to lie to you. I told you that. So, understand. So unfortunately, there's, I mean, you could do it. It's just, you ask if it was easy. It's not easy. If it's possible, yes. I mean, we've done it ourselves. We updated our Agile. Before we were using the Agile template, and then now we use Scrum. So we updated it that. But, I mean, we know how to do it, so it's kind of unfair on that end. But if you do not know what you're doing, it's hard. It's really, really hard, I would say. So I would not call it easy. Yes. Yes, the UE team has work items that are like user education and other things, and they also have those. So we have the same thing as everyone. We have work item for bugs. We have a work item for documents specifically. Not specifications, though. We do not have a work item for specs. But we do have for user education. We also have work items for tests and tasks and a couple of other things as well. So. I never feel like. I usually work in bugs, user experiences, and scenarios. That's usually. No, not necessarily. I mean, if it's in a scenario, then it's multiple sprints. And that would be, you kind of have your areas and iteration. You bound it to the right iteration, essentially, or area path. And then that's how we do that. So I'm being told to stop with 2 P's. So that means really stop. So. Okay, anything else? Ask me outside. I'll be there until whenever is the next session, and then I'll come back later, I think at 6 or whenever you guys end the conference, and then I'll be there for another 20 minutes after that. Thanks.